Imagine that one day you wake up to find unidentified agents in your room who arrest you for some unnamed crime. You don't know what you are supposed to have done, so you have no way to challenge the charges. The agents will give you no information, and everything you do to find out seems to make them suspect you more. This is the beginning of Franz Kafka's novel, The Trial. The story is meant to seem absurd and allegorical, but actually, it's not far from reality. Under legislation called a security certificate, the Canadian government can arrest any refugee or permanent resident on the basis of them being a supposed threat to national security. There are currently 5 Muslim men imprisoned. They can be held indefinitely without charge or bail and without access to the evidence against them. If the judge decides that it is possible that the evidence might be true, they can be deported with no chance of appeal. This 2-part long-term memory radio production of CKUT Radio is called Not So Fundamental Rights, Security Certificates and Secret Trials in Canada. In this first hour, we will discuss security certificate legislation and talk about the 5 men being held. We will hear from the lawyer of 3 of the men about the unjust nature of these cases and the difficulties of defending without access to the evidence. We will also hear about the effects of these arrests on the families of the detainees, as well as the experiences within Muslim communities in Canada. Mary Foster is an activist and member of the Coalition for Justice for Adil Sharkawi. She explains the security certificate process and tells us about the people being held. She also speaks about Adil Sharkawi's situation and how what is happening goes against Canadian notions of a fair trial.
A security certificate is issued by the government to arrest and detain refugees and immigrants when they allegedly are threats to national security. That's the textbook definition. We prefer to call it a secret trial process, and that's basically describing the kind of conditions that the person who's arrested will face. They're detained without charge, so they're not charged of any criminal activity, under secret evidence. They're not allowed to know what information there is or, in fact, is not against them. And they can be detained, in some cases, for years under that. It's a measure of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, so it's only applies, again, to certain people in Canada, not to everyone. The security certificates allows a really medieval process to take place. You are locked up. You don't know precisely why. You don't have any chance to see what the information might be against you, to the point where you can't, in most cases, you can't counter-interrogate or cross-examine the people who've apparently given information against you. You're also facing deportation after you've been labeled as a terrorist. That's a very, very serious thing. It's not just deportation, oh, well, we'll just start our life in, like, over again in our old country. As bad as that is, I don't want to belittle that kind of deportation either. But much worse than that, once you've been labeled a terrorist or a national security threat, it basically forces your country of origin to show that it's serious about fighting the war on terror and being with George Bush to arrest the person who's sent back home. And in all of the 5 cases we have now, experts have been quite unanimous that the people who are going to be deported will face torture, many other abuses of their rights, and possibly death if they're returned.
Could you talk a little bit about the 5 people who are currently being held?
There's 3 men in Toronto. Mohamed Majoub, he's been held for over 4 years. He's married and has 3 children. There's Mahmoud Jabala. He's married. He has 6 children. He has been arrested since August 2001. He's unique in having three security certificates, so he'll soon be facing the third time he's going through the security certificate process, the first one being thrown out, the second one being dismissed on a technicality. Hassan Almri, also held in Toronto. He's a single man. He's been held since October 2001. There's Mohamed Harkat. He's an Ottawa man. He was arrested on Human Rights Day in 2002. And his partner, Sophie Harkat, has been pretty tireless in campaigning to try and get him released. And then there's Adil Sharkawi here in Montreal, who's a Montrealer for 10 years, coming originally from Morocco. He's married and has two small children. His family's here as well. And he has been arrested for over a year. He's been in prison for 15 months now. He's the latest arrestee. He's also launched a constitutional challenge to the security certificate process. So he's fighting it on a number of different levels. We've been pursuing lots of different strategies on the political side of the campaign. Of course, there's a legal strategy too, but we've been working on the political side. We've been very clear in our demand for his release. Adil has been saying that all I'm asking for is a fair trial so that I can show that I'm innocent. So that's our second demand. If any case against him actually exists, then arrest him and let him fight it in a fair and independent trial. Thirdly, we've been asking for a guarantee that none of these men will be deported and that security certificates be abolished. And finally, we're trying to link it with the much broader push towards fascism in our society. And our final demand is on that broader level, which is to stop this kind of racist scapegoating of the Arab and Muslim communities and the broader attack on civil liberties in Canada. So those are our political demands, and we've been doing everything from community picnics as a kind of a fundraiser, but also mobilizer in a more relaxed environment, to a protest outside CSIS on the first anniversary of Sharkawi's arrest, to meeting with members of parliament to try and get some of them on side, meeting with larger organizations, press conferences, just a broad strategy of using as many means as we can to try and put pressure on the government to release him and to make it very difficult for them to do the completely unacceptable, which would be to deport them to torture.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically about in what ways he has not had due process within this trial?
Normally, when someone's arrested, they're told why. So that's one thing. He's not charged with anything. So that's kind of irregular to start with. Secondly, there's not full disclosure. The lawyer and Sharkawi himself are provided with public summaries and some information that may back up some of the allegations or suspicions that he's a threat to national security. For example, maybe someone has a fight with Adil's mom and goes to CSIS because CSIS is never very far from the Muslim Arab community, and, you know, gives some so-called information on him. Well, Adil has no way of knowing that, and he has no way of disputing something that's a complete fabrication. More than that, CSIS makes lots of mistakes. I don't think that's any surprise to a lot of people that the security agencies can just get wrong information. They can misinterpret information they have. Sometimes they're passed on information from another country without that information being sourced or without it being particularly clear. So that, again, is another set of mistakes that are made when or that can't be challenged because the lawyer has no access to this information and can't challenge some of the interpretations or errors that are made in whatever is in the files that CSIS has on him. More than that, there's a little clause in the law itself which says that normal standards of evidence are explicitly waived. That means that stuff can be hearsay. People can say, well, I heard that, he said that, and normally that would not enter into a courtroom. Normally that kind of stuff is just not considered credible enough to be used in a case with a very serious outcome for someone's life one way or the other. Another thing is that actually this is kind of going back to the secrecy, but it's a problem with the way CSIS works, is that information that's being passed on to them from other secret agents or agencies could be based on confessions under torture or plea bargains, which is both lacks credibility. Stuff that comes out when people are being tortured is not the most credible information in the world. And secondly, it's completely unethical that it would be used. I already mentioned earlier that there's no right to cross-examine witnesses. That doesn't mean that he can't cross-examine witnesses. It's just that it's not guaranteed as it normally would be. First of all, because you don't know who's given any information, so you can't say, well, I want to talk to that person who gave that information so that I can, you know, challenge them, because you don't know who it is. And or they might be, as in the case of Ahmed Ressam, who Adil has twice tried to, has asked to cross-examine. In that case, he's locked up in prison in the States. Hopefully, an arrangement can still be made. But at this point, the federal court has simply ignored that request to cross-examine that witness who has allegedly recognized Sharkawi from a photo. Another thing that shocks a lot of constitutional lawyers and experts and so forth is that there's no appeal. So once the federal court decides that possible that these allegations might be true, that's it. He can't appeal that. That's really going against liberal views of, you know, the rule of law. It's a basic principle of the rule of law. And in fact, that's one of the things that Sharkawi is arguing in his constitutional challenge, that this is unconstitutional not to have an appeal. A fundamental problem, global problem with the process is that he's actually not having a trial on whether or not any of these suspicions or allegations that have been made against him are true. He's having a trial on just whether it's possible that the allegations are true. What they're doing is looking at the original decision by the ministers to issue this security certificate and saying, was that reasonable? Is that possible that those suspicions are true? And if it's possible, then he's deported. That's a really low barrier. Normally, when you're accused of something, you get to fight it on the grounds of whether or not that accusation is true, but that's not the grounds on which this is fought. So all of those things are very much an abuse of normal process that frames the legal system in a liberal framework. Let my people go.
So what does it mean to not know the charges, to have no knowledge of the evidence against you? How does a person defend themselves against a shadow? Barbara Jackman is one of the lawyers defending Mohamed Majoub, Mahmoud Jabala, and Hassan Almrain, three men who are detained in Toronto. She speaks about the current state of their cases and the difficulties that their secret nature poses to her job. She also discusses the reasons why these procedures could not be used against Canadian citizens.
Omri's case and Mr. Majoub's case, security certificates were upheld by the federal court. That means that the federal court found it reasonable, that the ministers found it reasonable, that they were a threat to the security of Canada. And in those cases, both men so far have been denied release from custody, and the minister has decided to deport them to their respective countries, even though there's a risk of torture. So we're before the court on their application to be released from detention and trying to get the court to say that they cannot be removed from Canada. Mr. Jabala's case, he was nearing the end of the process as well, but the Federal Court of Appeal overturned the initial decision that he was a risk to the security of Canada, and so his case is going back to the very beginning. All three men are detained and have been detained for extended periods of time. What you get in these cases is a brief summary of the allegations, and you never see the evidence. other than newspaper articles or things like that. So you're arguing in the dark. Like usually when you go to a trial, for example, a criminal trial, you would cross-examine the witnesses and test their evidence to determine whether or not they're telling the truth or whether or not they perceive things correctly in terms of what they saw or heard or whatever. You can't do that in these cases. So whatever evidence the government's presented in secret, the judge doesn't get the opportunity to really have it tested as to whether or not it's credible. So someone could be going to the minister or the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and saying, I know this guy was connected with Osama bin Laden's organization, and really what it is that the person owes him money, and he wants to get the person in trouble because the person hasn't paid back the money. I mean, you have no way of knowing what the evidence is, who the people are that have come forward, well, maybe from other governments. And like Mr. Majoub and Mr. Jabala's case, the government of Egypt has laid charges against them for their political beliefs, and so you can be sure the government of Egypt's not going to give a good report. That's a real serious problem. The best you can do as a lawyer is try and guess what information the government might have and where it comes from, and then try to address it by calling witnesses. This whole procedure that these men are going through is under the Immigration Act, and the test for making the decision against them and for having the court uphold it is what's called reasonable grounds. So it's possible that the evidence might be true, and it's possible that if it's true that the person may be a terrorist. It doesn't have to meet even a standard that would be applied in, a civil proceeding. If you're suing someone for breaching a contract, you go to court to get damages. In those cases, the court has to determine if it's more likely than not. So in other words, is there a better than 50% chance that this is true? And in criminal trials, of course, it has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a very high standard. In these cases, for non-Canadian citizens under the Immigration Act, it's a less than 50% chance it's true, so it might only be 20% chance that it's true. 80% chance it's not true, and the court still has to act on it. Canadian citizens do not have to face that kind of proceeding. When the anti-terrorism legislation was put in place, the government provided for a secret process in the context of criminal trials. So if the government wants to keep information secret from the court where a person's been charged with a terrorism offense, they can go to federal court and get an order protecting that information so the person doesn't see it. But for Canadians, there has to be either proof beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal, or if the government's suing them for something, it's more than a 50% chance that they did something wrong or something like that. Non-citizens, the standard's so low that the government really doesn't have to do anything to prove its case. So when you couple the low standard with the fact that it's all presented in secret, what chance does the person have as a non-citizen facing deportation to a country where they may be at risk of persecution? One of the things that's really upsetting about all of these cases is our government is prepared to send people back to torture when they acknowledge that they'd be tortured on evidence that may not even be true, and they know it. Another serious concern about all these cases is that if our government truly believe that these men were involved in terrorist activities, the government could have laid criminal charges against them. They have the authority to do that under the criminal code. So you question why they didn't do it. All that they have to do to lay a charge is have a reasonable belief that they could secure a criminal conviction. And in all three cases, they've not done that. So I think it speaks to the weakness of the government's case. And then I think another factor that's significant is to look at the difference in treatment between these three men and other Arab Canadians. There's the case of Maher Arar, where the United States deported him to Syria. When he came back to Canada, it's a bit murky, but it would appear that the security service in Canada had a concern about him. He's not been detained in Canada, because there's not a law to detain him. He's a Canadian citizen. If he wasn't a Canadian citizen, I bet you he would be just like the other non-citizens who are facing deportation proceedings. And there's several other Canadians in the same situation. And the Syrian man Nuruddin, who was detained and tortured in Syria, is a Canadian citizen. And it would appear he was tortured in Syria because of information the Canadians have given. They may have suspicion, but they're not doing anything against any of these people because they're Canadians. The one thing we thought we had secured in terms of rights for refugees was the right not to be returned to a country where the refugee would be tortured. In 2002, the Supreme Court of Canada indicated in a case called Suresh and the Minister of Immigration, the Supreme Court indicated that Canada could not return anyone to torture. The Supreme Court said, you can't return to torture, it's an absolute bar under international law. We could theoretically conceive of exceptional conditions such as a time of war or state of emergency where it might be acceptable. It's apparent from what the Supreme Court said that they were considering that you might have to do it if you're in a time of war and you can't control the person because you don't have the means or the facilities because you're in a war. What the government has done since the Supreme Court of Canada decision in the Suresh case is decide that even though these men would be at risk of torture, it's justifiable to send them back to the country where they would face torture because there's exceptional reasons to do so. Now, the exceptional reasons appear to be that there are security concerns for Canada. So we're now back in court, again trying to reaffirm the right to be free from torture. The government said when they created this process that it was meant to be a quick process so that it was justifiable to continue the detention of a person while the security certificate process was going on. That's what they told Parliament. They had to have known that these procedures would not be done in a short period of time. They're complicated cases. And, you know, I have not had a case where the proceeding has been addressed or finished within less than a year and a half. Most of them take 2-3 years to get it through the court system to have a decision made and the person become eligible to apply for release from jail. People are being held in jail for extended periods of time under appalling conditions. I mean, in Mr. Omri's case, we had to go to the court to ask the court to tell the jail authorities to let him wear shoes. Mr. Omri has been in solitary confinement since October 2001. 3 years solitary confinement in Canada. He's never faced a criminal charge. Mr. Jabal and Mr. Majoub have been in and out of solitary. Mr. Majoub is now in solitary again. The man appeared to have faced serious racism from different jail authorities. The whole situation is just unacceptable. In fact, it's so unacceptable that one of the judges involved in the case, Justice Mackay, characterized it as Canada's own Guantanamo Bay. And I don't think that's far from the truth. When they put the security certificate provisions into the Immigration Act, they were more strict than the American provisions. And we got this security legislation process in 1992, so it's been in place a long time. At least until September 11th, the Americans did not put people in jail based on mere association. Canada deports people or puts them in jail, depending on which procedures used, virtually on the basis of past association. So, you know, someone wrote for a PLO magazine, they're going to be denied admission to Canada because it was PLO magazine, not that they did anything wrong or would do anything wrong. So Canada's laws were actually more draconian in the immigration section than the United States until September 11th. Since September 11th, I think that the anti-terrorism legislation has been, because of a perceived pressure, an actual pressure from the Americans to put in stricter laws that will be broader to catch persons of concern to the Canadian government. Canada is very conscious of the fact that the Americans think all the terrorists in their country are coming from our country, and so Canada has drafted legislation to try and anticipate those concerns, I think. Since September 11th, it's just been increased. I think where the real American pressure comes, pressure is who gets targeted. There certainly was targeting of Arab Muslims before September 11th, but they were targeting Tamils who were supportive of the liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam in Sri Lanka, Sikhs who had supported in the past, you know, the Sikh cause for independence in India. There was a lot of targeting and still is a lot of targeting of Palestinians. Those targetings continue, actually. It just seems to be that the focus now is more on people who may have been associated with persons associated with bin Laden's group. The difference between immigration proceedings and criminal is the standards lower. In immigration, the evidence can be a newspaper article. So, for instance, in Hassan Omri's case, there was an article in one of the American newspapers about how there was a belief that honey importers may have been laundering money for bin Laden or using their honey businesses to transport guns. Well, Hassan ran a little honey stall in the library in his town, which is like a market stall, and they used that honey article to allege that he may have been involved in transporting arms. I mean, how much arms can you have, can you hide in a pint of honey? It's not like he was a big business person transporting millions of tons of honey. He was the little guy that bought the honey to sell at the stall in the market. That would never be accepted in a criminal court or even in a civil court. So there's a big difference in terms of the kind of evidence. That's on top of the secret evidence that they're presenting, but mostly the government's cases seem to be that the court is to draw an inference. Because you might have had dinner at someone's house one night, that you're a member of an organization because Canada thinks that guy had links to some terrorist organization. They think if they put enough of these inferences together, what you end up with is proof that the person possibly was a member of a terrorist organization. I mean, it's just the most... To characterize it as a kangaroo court or as a Kafkaesque kind of hearing is probably too kind to the process.
We huddle close in the thin air. Most of us can hear. When my mom, she stare away in a high chair. Some of us live there, waiting to die where. Pain and blame, they fade away with the price fair. Plotting a heist care. To share your strategy is do or die when we ride with this gravity. Life a calamity, they steady grabbing me. Put me in the cell, but fail, never silence me. The totality of fears that you try to hide.
One of the biggest issues with the secret trial process is that people are forced to live in the terrible conditions of Canadian prisons with no chance of bail without ever having been charged, let alone convicted. Diana Ralph is a member of the Campaign to Stop Secret Trials in Toronto. Since 2003, she has been acting as an adopted family member for Hassan Omri. She speaks about what he has lived through in prison and throughout this process and the reasons why she chose to link her life with his. That'll just get you locked. No stars in the sky now. It's do or die now. Once they got you locked. Too much aggravation, incarceration. Don't let your mind get locked. Yeah. Lock. Yeah. Lock. Lock. Yeah. Most of us already been low. That's why we tough though. I demand you comprehend how the guts go. You gotta duck low when all the shots blow. And cops lock the block. Better be careful. And all them shackles ain't nothing but lassos.
In June of 2003, I was asked to, among a whole bunch of other people, to go and offer bail surety for Hassan Omri at his bail hearing on I think June 23rd. And when I went down there, they asked me why I was doing that. And I said that as a Jew whose father had been a Nuremberg war crimes lawyer, I felt a deep obligation to stand up against the targeting of Muslims in the same way that Jews had gotten targeted in the 30s in Germany. And I also said that I had read Hassan's statement and that it was clear to me that he was a young man who had just been caught up in world events that were bigger than him and that that was now being used against him. So after that, the translator who was working with Hassan in the court came out and said that Hassan had been very touched by what I had said, and I said that I would be glad to connect with him and talk to him, and actually really got to like him. He has a good sense of humor, and he has an enormous integrity and courage. And shortly after that, in October, he went on a hunger strike because the jail gets freezing cold in the wintertime. In fact, a couple of prisoners had died of one had died of hypothermia and one had been taken to the hospital nearly dead with hypothermia in the same cell that he's in. So he went on a hunger strike for better jail conditions, and I went on one with him, and at that point I decided that I would adopt him, you know, as his family here in Canada. He came to Canada in 1999, I think, as a refugee from Saudi Arabia. And he set up a small pita business. He was really eager to learn how to speak English and how to connect with people. He was really enthusiastic about Canada. One day he came home and discovered that things had been moved around, and that's when he realized that CSIS was, or someone had been spying on his place. The next thing he knew, they just came and arrested him, and he was thrown into solitary confinement at Metro West Detention Center in Toronto, and nobody would tell him why he was in solitary confinement. There were no charges against him. He wasn't allowed to talk to any people. He wasn't allowed to call his friends, and the only person he was allowed to talk to was his lawyer.
The solitary confinement cell is about the size of a slightly large bathroom. He initially had no sheets or blanket, no pillow, and he got quite depressed and was kind of frantic, and Barb Jackman, his lawyer, was great and kept trying to go out and keep his spirits up and talk to him, but he was shattered. He couldn't figure out what was going on. He knew he had done nothing wrong. The jail was freezing cold in the winter. He was just really isolated. And then finally, Matthew Behrens, with the Campaign to Stop Secret Trial, began making some connections with the other prisoners. And then after we began working with him, his spirits began to lift. The way he stayed alive and stayed healthy is amazing, and the way he kept his mental health was amazing. He treated the other guards with great respect and humor, and they came to really like him, so that by the time he went on this 40-day hunger strike and Barb finally managed to get his jail conditions taken to the Ontario court as a charter violation, five of the guards risked their jobs to come and testify for him. It was funny to be in court because the jail officials had all said, no, the temperature's just fine, and they had computer printouts proving that the temperature was just fine and that Hassan was just being unreasonable, and they were offering to give him clothing. It turned out it was women's clothing, and they were offering to move him to what might be a warmer unit, but it turns out that it's the psychiatric ward where they have violent sex offenders. And then the guards came in, and they were great. They just said, no, it's freezing cold in there. We have to wear our coats and boots, and we have a space heater, and I don't know how these guys stand it. And they actually leaked us jail documents showing that two previous guys had nearly died in there, and one did. And he won. He won his shoes, and they had given him extra blankets, and they warmed up the jail for the first time probably since the early 70s. The segregation unit is designed mainly for people who are, as a way of punishing people or for people who are out of control. But Hassan is there for his own defense, his self-defense. After he'd been in solitary for about 13 months and the jail realized that he was no threat at all and actually had reduced his threat rating, Hassan went on a previous hunger strike, and they had allowed him to go onto the general range. He was there for, I think, less than 3 days, and several of the other prisoners badly beat him up. And he was dragged out by the guards, and they threw him back into the same cell that he'd been in solitary. And they said, you have to file a complaint against the men who beat you up. So he signed this complaint against these guys, and then the guards said, now that you've ratted, if you ever go back to the general population, they'll kill you. So you're stuck here. So he's in solitary for his own protection. He has never done anything the least bit violent. He's very clear. He says, I'm not a criminal. Other people here may be criminals, but I'm not. And he just lives with as much integrity as he can.